time to listen to the interviews from Ireland Life on Saturday the 19th of February 2011. Ireland Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by Ireland, the stockist of Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local gifts, art and clothing. On Saturday the 19th of February, Sharim Brown talked to the head boy of Waiheke High School. She talked to Brian Griffiths from Forest and Bird and Waiheke resident and Greenpeace campaigner Carly Thomas.
And now I've got in the studio with me Ryan, who's the head boy at Waiheke High School, and Clayton, who's one of the prefects. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey.
So tell us about that process of being elected to becoming a prefect. How does that work?
Well, to become a prefect, we had to apply, and then the senior management team chose about 10 of us out of about the 25 people that applied for it. And to go for a head boy or head girl, the prefects had to write another application letter. We had to hand in our CV, and we had to have an interview with the principal, Mr. Watson, and then we all had to say a speech in front of the school, and then the school, every student had a vote, and then the senior management chose.
Oh, okay, so it was a combination of a vote and what the senior management chose. So it seems to be, so the role of the head boy and girl is quite an important role?
Yeah, it is. We are leaders, we're the role models of the school. We've got to set an example to our peers and younger students. And, yeah.
Lovely. So you guys went on a leadership program for prefects and head boys and girls at AUT. How did that go?
It was awesome. We went for 3 days and it was awesome. We met heaps of cool people from the AUT University. We were there with three other schools. And yeah, we learnt a lot.
So what kinds of things did you do on the course?
Well, we made a business plan of what we plan to accomplish this year. And yeah, basically just learning how to become a leader, a role model for peers and younger students of the high school.
Lovely. See, that's so far away from me growing up. Business plan and head boy and girl, that just doesn't, in my head, I'm just like, oh, that's odd. How does that work? So presumably you developed a sort of a set of goals for this year?
Yep.
So what do you specifically want to achieve as, you know, the prefects and head boy and girl?
Definitely participation in we have our houses in our school, and we want to increase participation. Saying like our events, like we've got beach sports coming up next Friday. That's always a huge event every year. Then following that, the week after, we have Athletics Day. We just want to increase participation for like house spirit. We've got sport competitions on during the year, during lunch times and stuff.
So what do you mean by increased participation? Sorry, I must be in a really, I don't have kids at high school, but doesn't everyone just have to do the sport? I mean, what's this about, you know, encouraging participation? Don't you just have to do it because that's what's happening?
Nah, not really. You've got a choice if you really want to do it or not, but as prefects, one of our main goals this year is to get everyone participated with the house competitions. It's like a bit of school spirit kind of thing. And we have the Matariki celebration every year when the whole school gets together. We have a big hangi. We have an inter-house kapa haka competition. And last year that took off. That went very well. And this year we're trying to better it.
Oh, cool. Good. And have you got anything to add to that, Clayton? What are your particular interests? What would you like to see happen at the school this year?
Mainly our attendance for year 13. Because Mr. Watson, he said if we get our attendance up to 90%, we can go out at lunchtime to get our food.
Oh,
so
okay.
That would be really good. And right. It's just, if everyone comes to school, it's just better. It's good for everyone.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So he said that if you can get, 90% attendance in the first term, then the second term you might be able to have lunchtimes off premises.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah.
How cool is that? Yeah, I used to have lunchtimes off premises. And I'll tell you something, and I'm sure principals aren't going to like this very much, but I went to school in Belgium. And so our last years of school, there was a pub across the road. And at 16, you can drink in Belgium. You can drink beer. You can't drink spirits, but you can drink beer. So our lunchtimes, we used to go over. And the thing about Belgium is they didn't have, it's a different attitude to drinking. So, sometimes you'd have a cup of tea, or you'd have a lemonade, or you'd have a beer, or, people just drank all kinds of different things. But it was just across the road from the school, and we did go down there. So, I'm sure he wouldn't want to hear that story. good. So one of the things that people often say about Waiheke, there's nothing for young people to do, and, they get bored and all of this carry on. And I always think, well, how can you possibly get bored on an island with amazing beaches and, a climate that really allows you to be outdoors quite a lot of the time, free barbecues? What's the story? What's your take on that?
I don't know why people say that. I believe that we are truly privileged. We're lucky to live on an island like this. It's paradise. We've got beautiful beaches surrounding us. Everyone knows each other. We're all friendly. It's a very social place.
Mm. So can we talk about alcohol on the island? Is that like a big issue for young people on the island? People, some people think it is. Or do you think it's just a minority of kids and adults who don't manage their alcohol?
I believe there is the drinking culture, the age where people are drinking is just getting younger and younger. We go out and we see 12-year-olds, 13, 14-year-olds out drinking. They're just totally wasted and doesn't look very good.
It's really ugly, isn't it?
Yep.
So what do you think could be done about things like that? Have you got any thoughts on that?
Our prefix team, we're starting a new what's it called? SAD team.
Oh, okay.
And that means Students Against Drink Driving.
Right.
The police came in and talked to us prefects, and we're trying to make a group that at school and just encourage people that for younger students, it's not that cool to drink, and especially not cool to drink drive and stuff.
Because some countries have a really strong rule around that, in Israel, my ex-partner's Israeli, and they're not allowed to drink and drive at all. So if there's any trace of alcohol in your blood and you've been driving, then that's a huge penalty, and that sort of takes care of that problem. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that's a bit hard. I think the under 20 rule, zero tolerance, just like that, is fine, but I reckon for older people, if you want to have a beer or two after work, after a long day, it's nothing wrong with that. And then you're not drunk, you can still drive home.
Okay, great. So what are some of your other projects then? So this thing around, is the school a focus for activities outside of school time?
Yeah, we've got a few sporting teams and academies. Like, we're both in the Sea Sports Academy.
Great.
That's a really cool thing. We go out every Thursday and do cool activities.
Lovely. So what are you involved in that as well, Clayton? What kinds of things do you do?
The level 3 course we're doing this year, a dive course. So we get our dive certificate and then we go to Barrier or Poor Nights. So that's quite a privilege for us. And also we do fishing for our exchange students. If they don't, like in Germany and stuff, some people have never fished in their life. They haven't been to a proper beach. We go to the beaches, we go fishing, all that kind of stuff. And it's really we're privileged to have the sea right next to us because it's so easy to do our course, basically.
So that's amazing to be able to do diving through school.
And Poor Nights and Barrier are amazing place to dive. You see, it's just, it's it's kind of breathtaking, basically.
Mm. So can you guys already dive?
I can, but some of the people in my course before last year, because it's a two-year course, they've never snorkeled really. So we do that in the first year course as well, and then we do a Goat Island trip. So that's quite good as well.
Mm. So can I ask you, you guys are both year 13 now?
Yep.
Lovely. So what are your ambitions for next year?
I think I want to try out for the Air Force myself and try and get into that.
Oh, okay. Why is that? Any particular?
I like being active. I don't want to sit behind a desk. But yeah, that's what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yep. Right, what about you?
I'd like to go to AUT University and study sport and recreation, and I'm thinking of a path down physical education teaching and or personal training.
Okay, yeah. There's already a lad who's gone off to study sport and recreation at AUT, isn't there, from Waiheke High School last year or the year before?
Yeah, I've got several mates who I know at AUT studying, and they said it's such a great awesome course. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, lovely. Good. So, well, I guess last question. What makes Waiheke High School special?
I think it is just so friendly. Like, it's just like our Waiheke reputation. Everyone's just so friendly. Everyone knows each other. It's just like a big family, like a big community. And there's not many... I don't think there's many other schools in New Zealand that... right on a cliff and can see the ocean. We're on a very beautiful place.
Yeah, ain't that the truth? And it's also, like, I think it's amazing, like, kids can actually walk to school along the beach.
Yeah, that's awesome. I used to do it a bit until I moved.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, I did want to ask you something else. I noticed there, I don't know if you've noticed, but it seems like the bike rack is quite full at the high school at the moment. Are more kids cycling? Do you have any ideas on that? Because it just seems like they're...
There's a lot of people biking to school. It's fine. It's good.
Good. Great. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, guys. Did you want to say anything else about your school or?
When we're on our AUT prefect training program camp, we're supposed to come up with a vision statement for our team for the year. Usually we're only allowed 20 minutes to spend on creating it, but it took us an hour and a half, but it was well worth it. And that vision statement is, small yet diverse, we paint our legacy with the true colours of our island. And our colours is metaphorically for trust, loyalty, respect, integrity and commitment.
Okay, excellent. So that's the thing that you guys developed?
Yeah.
Okay, and how do you think is that going to be used? How will that sort of feed through into the school this year, do you think?
We're going to lead by example, and with all our colours, we're going to use them and spread it around the school and just, yeah, be role models. For the school.
Is that the first time that you've been on a leadership program, that the prefects have been on a leadership program?
Yeah, pretty much, yes.
Right, okay.
It's the first time our year's been on it, but last year they did one as well.
Okay, lovely. So are all the prefects taken from year 13?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. Hey, well, thanks a lot. Good luck this year. Good luck in your roles as prefect and head boy. Have a lovely year.
Cool, thank you.
And yeah, do really well. Thanks cool. very much.
Thanks very much.
Coming in. Well, I'm here with Brian Griffiths now, who's the chairperson of the Hauraki Gulf Forest and Bird. Hi, Brian.
Hi there, Sharon.
Hi. So tell us, are there any new initiatives this year or any new tracks that you'd like to talk about?
Well, yes, as it happens, we've just started over the last couple of months a major upgrade of the tracks in the Onatangi Reserve, which is the biggest and oldest of the three forest and bird reserves on the island. And this upgrade is going to take quite a bit of time. We have actually just about completed one of the legs of the track, but we've got about five or six more to do. So it's going to take us a number of years and many, many thousands of dollars to actually complete the upgrade.
So just to clarify, that's the reserve where the kauri trees are?
That's the reserve where the kauri grove is, yes.
Yes. Okay. And so who's doing this work?
It will be mostly done by local contractors, but there will be some quite considerable voluntary input as well. But mostly this will be done by professionals, because there is quite a lot of skill that's required to do these tracks correctly.
Right. Okay. And so does that mean there'll be new tracks through the grove, or just that the existing tracks will be safer to walk on?
Good question. I think as it's going to turn out, it will actually be basically a new track network. We will be able to make use of the southern ring of the track, which is along Fisher Road, but the rest of it will be largely replaced. We'll have the steep, very steep, rather dangerous in parts, old tracks replaced by tracks that zigzag downwards and are going to be much easier, easier gradients, and much more comfortable and safer for people to use. I think it should encourage a lot more people to use the reserve, which is, of course, exactly what we have in mind.
Mm. I was there the other day, and I was just wondering, if you want to try and get out on Onitangi Beach, is the closest exit to that the one up on Waiheke Road? Because that's where we came out, and then I thought, I don't know if there's one closer, but it would be so great if there was something that had better access to the beach so that you're not walking down the road.
Obviously
there are trees in the way, but
that's the Roy Nelson Gate, which are the main entrance. That is the closest one to the beach, but in fact the best way, the most interesting way down, is to go across the road and go into the Waiheke Reserve just across the road.
Come out of the Forest and Bird, come out of the gate and cross the road, and there's another entrance to something.
That's right.
Oh, okay.
Waiheke Reserve, across the road, you go through that and up to the top, and then down First Avenue and down to the beach.
Oh, lovely. And there's a track there? Because
yes.
I could see a couple of driveways, but obviously it wasn't looking. Yeah. Is it marked?
Yes, clearly. Yes.
Right. Yeah. Obviously wasn't looking on the other side of the road.
Yeah.
Okay. Ah, so you can actually do the whole loop without really being on the road very much.
Yes, you can indeed.
Okay, great. Okay, and are you involved with that Awaroa track? Or?
Yes, well, that's it is actually an Auckland City initiative, and of course it's Rob Fenwick's land that the track is going through. Forest and Bird is involved just marginally, I suppose, because we have a lot to do with council and with Rob Fenwick. That is a magnificent track going from Awaroa to Te Matuku, and it's going to be, I think, one of the highlights of the Waiheke track network, and I would certainly recommend it for people to walk on, because there's some absolutely magnificent views, really, really breathtaking views.
How long does it take to walk?
It actually takes an hour to an hour and a half in just one direction, so it's you need to allow yourself quite a lot of time.
Is it suitable for children?
Yes, it is. It is suitable because the gradients are quite reasonable gradients. There's just one disadvantage at the Awaroa end, because the track has to come down a very, very steep hill, and it's a very, very narrow restricted easement that carries the track. It's extremely steep and rather difficult to go up and down. So at the moment, that is one of the rather disappointing parts of the track. But you can, in time, hopefully, that will be improved, and That will make all the difference. But the track as a whole is certainly quite suitable for children. Yeah. Mm.
Is it very exposed, or is it through bush, or because you mentioned the views? I'm just thinking of the sun pounding down. Is it better?
It's
to do in autumn or something.
No, I mean I think it's really an all year round track. It is mostly through bush, but that at the end of it, if you're going in from the Timutuku end, you come out above Awaroa Bay, and it's a magnificent power site, which is interesting in itself, but it also provides almost 360-degree views, quite breathtaking views, so it's worth it. And you can avoid going down the very steep part by just simply retracing the steps.
Turning around and going back when you see the drop.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, lovely, good. Okay, and any other... there was all that walking, sort of twilight walks and stuff. Is that happening again this year?
Well, we had twilight rambles, of course, in January, as happens every January. Mm. And yeah, the walks are always pretty popular.
I was away, that's why I missed all of that, because I was thinking, I didn't see anything on those. Yeah.
Yeah, so yes, they will. As far as I know, they will continue each January, and Auckland, the Auckland Council provides some funding for that. And for the last few years, Forest and Bird has done the organising of the walks and done the sausage sizzle afterwards and that sort of thing. So I presume the same thing will continue.
Do you notice more and more people coming, or is it pretty much a steady group?
It's one of the things that I think is happening. The numbers did drop off a little bit this year, and one of the reasons might be is that we now have walks almost all year round. And there was, of course, that very successful walking festival last year, towards the end of the year, which was very, very well supported and very successful. So there is now much more opportunity for walking than there used to be. It's lost a bit of novelty value.
And I suspect also, if it's catering to local people, what I found really great is that you go on one of these walks once, and then you know where the walk goes, and then you can go on it yourself. So you kind of need to have the walk, but maybe it'll be less attended in the future. But on the other hand, you've got more people using the walkways.
That's a really, really good way of looking at it. Yes, of course, it is. It's a learning curve that people are on. They a lot of people don't realise just what a wonderful, wonderful track network we've got on Waiheke. It's very special and very unique.
Mm. And I find, especially with children, it's actually quite nice to be told, look, this walk is going to take an hour and a half. You can take your children on it, and there's a sausage sizzle at the end. So you've got the incentive to get them on the walk, and you know that you're with a group of people. So and you know that it's the length of time it's going to take, where you're not setting out on your own trying to work out where the track's going, or wondering, you know, when you're going to get there.
That's right.
Okay, great. So other initiatives that you're involved with in Forest and Bird? What are that? So there's the track upgrade. Is there anything else that's...
Well, a lot of the things that we do, we've been doing for years and years and years, forever it seems. I mean, we've got, as far as the Onatangi Reserve is concerned, the one that I'm most involved in, being the ranger of the reserve, an ongoing restoration program which involves... tree planting and weed control, it's going to be many, many years before that is completed, because it just seems to go on forever. And then of course the Atafai Reserve project is continuing, is ongoing. The project that Don Chappell started way back in 1993, I think, was when it actually got underway. A wonderful project. So these are ongoing projects. Pest control, we're certainly doing a lot in the rat eradication, rat control on the island, and working with council in that enterprise.
So over time, have you noticed that there are more, because the whole point of this is to have a more diverse flora and fauna and have more native birds around the place. Have you noticed over time that there are actually more birds around?
I would say that there is evidence, yes, but it's very, very difficult to measure. I mean, one of the things that is an indication that something is something good has been happening is the carcass sightings over the last year or two. We're getting far more carcass coming onto the island and passing through than ever before. So that's an encouraging sign. There certainly are.
Which are the kaka? Are they the wood pigeons? No.
The kaka is a parrot, if you like.
Oh, yes. But, yeah. We've seen heaps of them in our garden.
Yes. So
the little green ones.
The green ones, yes.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
It's the first year I've seen so many.
Yeah.
I don't think I remember seeing them before.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And they that's an indication that we're doing something right. I mean, I don't know whether we'll ever get rid of all of the rats, but every dead rat really is a good rat, so as far as I'm concerned. And one of the things I would like to say is that encouraging people to actually get behind Forests and Bird and the council and conservation people to actually do something about the predator, the rat problem, and of course, if we can get rid of more rats, we're going to encourage more native birds.
So, quick plug: how can we get rid of the rats? What should people be doing?
Well, they should be.
A lot of people will already
they
know.
Should be coming to the market on Saturday morning and talking to Marlene at the Forest and Bird stall and getting themselves set up with bait stations and some rat bait.
Lovely. And what's the kind of cost of that?
It's not a great cost. For just a few dollars, a few dollars a month, you can make a considerable contribution to the pest control project on the island.
Lovely. So if I put it out rat baits and I kill a rat, what do I then do with the rat? What am I going to do with it?
You won't actually see the rat.
Oh, great.
The rat will go away. It depends on there are various ways, of course, of killing rats, and you can do it using traps, which actually hold the rat, a dead rat. That means you have a dead rat to dispose of, but you don't have to do it that way.
No, thank you. Yes. Okay. Good. So you can just give them some poison, so they go off and die miserably
and
somewhere
else. They'll do their own thing. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So a friend of mine put it like this: that conservation in New Zealand is all about pest control. So although it seems that there's a sort of a dark side of it, in the sense that you're killing all these rats, which can be quite unpleasant, but on the other hand, you're protecting all these little bird chicks and eggs and allowing the local flora and fauna.
It's all really part of the natural machinery that operates in Mother Nature, and it has a beautiful side, but it has a very, very unpleasant side too, and there's a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, but I'm afraid that is the way nature works, and often we have to do some rather bad things to get long term good out of it. And most of us are very, we don't enjoy using traps and using poisons. But when you see what rats do to birds, then it does certainly open your eyes and makes you realise that there are two sides to this question.
Mm. Yeah. And the other thing you can do is, if you want to be more actively involved, you can actually join Forest and Bird.
Well, that would be the best thing possible for you to do.
Yes.
Yes, we'd love to have you.
And there's an active kids programme as well, isn't there?
There's the KCC. The Kiwi Conservation Club, which is the junior part of Forest and Bird, and that's very worth joining. Mm.
Lovely, good. So again, one can go down and see the stall.
We can give you all of that information on the Saturday stall.
Lovely. And so then, what kinds of activities would you get involved with if you were?
Well,
in Forest and
Bird? there is a program which operates a number of times a year. There are activities, events organised for children, especially for children. So you can you can join in those, and of course you can also join in the activities that the adults are involved in too. And the publications that are put out by the KCC are absolutely outstanding. It's most absolutely first class educational material. Mm. Very interesting, very informative.
Mm. Oh, great. Okay, good. Now, on another note, you live in Onitangi, and I noticed that you put a letter into the Gulf News last week, and there's been some muscle cleanup since then. Any thoughts on how that's going?
Well, I would have to say, on the face of it, it really does look as if they are doing a pretty good job of cleaning up the beach, making the beach more presentable for use, more user-friendly, if you like. However, I still am really, and Forest and Bird is still very concerned about the long-term picture, the fact that we still don't seem to have come to terms with why this thing has happened. It's a most unusual, unprecedented event. We need to find out why it has happened so that we can prepare ourselves in the event that it happens again. We need to know, because it may well happen again. And there may be something that we are doing that we can stop doing to help the situation. Mm. So Forest and Bird is actually making moves to try and find out a little bit more about what is behind this.
And who would be the people who would need to find that information out? Is that the council?
Well, we have yes, the council should be doing this, and we have as a branch approached somebody in council, marine scientist, to see if he can throw a little bit of light on the situation and maybe point us in the direction of perhaps other people who might be able to advise us. But council, of course, should be doing this, and the Hauraki Gulf Forum will be a good platform, in fact, to actually give us a little bit of an airing. Mm-hmm. And
I was quite surprised at how quickly the cleanup took place. I was just curious to know where that funding came from, because they're always talking about how you can't get funding for anything and blah, 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 and then suddenly, like, overnight, the beach is... they've worked really, really hard on it. They've done a sterling job in actually getting rid of the stuff.
Don't misunderstand me here, but I know that there has been a bit of pressure put on to get it done before the beach races.
Oh, of
and
course, yes, because no, that would be a bit hopeless, wouldn't
that's,
it?
That's okay, but as long as it doesn't compromise the longer term approach to the issue, so it's there's much more to it than just getting the beach nice and tidy and flat for the beach races.
Yes, indeed. Okay, well, listen, thanks so much for coming in. You've been listening to Brian Griffiths from Forest and Bird talking about the tracks. Thank you so much, and the mussels and all
Pleasure.
Kinds of different things. Lovely.
Pleasure.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke people, events and issues, brought to you by Island Art, Craft, Giftware, Clothing and Bric-a-Brac, Ocean View Road, Onirua.
I'm here with Carly Thomas, and she's the ocean spokesperson. You're the ocean spokesperson?
I'm the oceans campaigner with Greenpeace.
Lovely, great. And the reason I've got Carly here is that I was watching the news on, was it Thursday night? Wednesday night, and there was some news about the whaling, and you were the spokesperson then. So, great. So tell us what that's all about.
Well, since that news, which was essentially a rumour that the Japanese government might be calling off their annual whaling program early, that's been confirmed, and the Fisheries Agency of Japan has announced that they'll be recalling their whaling fleet. And obviously this is a fantastic piece of news for everyone that's been involved in opposing whaling, and, you know, people, organisations and governments that have been in this campaign for decades now. And we hope this is going to end whaling forever and be a final trip that they take to the Southern Ocean.
Wow, lovely. So how? What's that decision based on, do you think, the fact that they've, reduced the season?
Really, this is the result of so many factors that have been putting increasing pressure on the Japanese government in terms of continuing this whaling program. So they've been coming under economic pressure, public pressure in Japan and around the world, political, legal pressure, and this has just been mounting. And on the other hand, they're producing a product that most people in Japan simply don't want anymore. They've got more than 5,000 tons of frozen whale meat in storage in Japan, and there's simply not a market for this product. So they're actually wearing a lot of criticism, both internationally and locally, for something that's, you know, it's not a viable industry in this century.
Mm. Now, I know there's always lots of shenanigans around the whaling things and people saying stuff and then not doing them and all of this stuff. So the fact that they've actually said that they're now turning around, does that mean that they can be trusted, or do they still need to be followed in case they change their minds? And
I think that it would be quite unlikely, having had an official statement from the fisheries agency, that they would turn around. But certainly, you know, it's always a bit of a guessing game to find out what's going on with the Southern Ocean whaling operations each year. They usually announce but don't tell exactly when they'll leave from Japan, and then we don't know exactly when the hunting starts until someone comes across them and starts to expose what they're doing down there. And usually, you know, we know for sure they've finished when they get back to Japan, essentially. And in terms of what they've done down there and how many whales they've killed, that doesn't become available until they report it to the International Whaling Commission. And obviously that's an important study document for anyone that's involved in the campaign to end whaling, to find out exactly where they've been, what they've taken.
Mm. So has the attitude to whaling in Japan also changed? Because one of the things that happened in Japan when I lived there 20 years ago is that people either didn't really know anything about the whaling, the general Japanese public didn't know anything, or if they did, they were like, well, that's just what we do, and didn't really engage with it. Has that changed in Japan?
I think there's been a really significant change in Japan in terms of the view of the Japanese government's whaling program. Around 70% of Japanese people don't support whaling in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. And there's a big realization when people understand that Japan is the only country which is violating an internationally agreed whale sanctuary so far from their own waters. So there's a lot of, you know, previously there's been a lot of just general public apathy and people not knowing that that was actually happening. So they're definitely told one line by the Japanese government, which is it's a very controlled scientific program. They're not told that, you know, more than 1,000 whales are being taken in an area that the world, the global community, has agreed is vital for whales and should be designated a sanctuary. On top of that, 98% of Japanese people really or never eat whale meat these days. There's a kind of historic tradition of eating whale meat, and many older people in Japan remember eating it following the Second World War, when there was really a food shortage, and they were actually encouraged by the US government to go whaling to help alleviate that shortage. So there's a kind of a historical connection. But, you know, there's so many countries that have hunted whales in the past, including New Zealand, that have turned around completely. I mean, we've now got a thriving whale watching business in Kaikoura. Whale Watch Kaikoura is just the sort of example of turning a tradition around, and, you know, that tradition is still based on whales, but now it's an appreciation and conservation of those whales. And we've been involved in protests along with Whale Watch Kaikoura against the continued whaling program.
Oh, right, interesting. And so who are the baddies now then? Well, obviously the Japanese will stay baddies until they you know, change their policy completely, but are the Norwegians still hunting whales? I thought they also were, you know, pro-whaling.
There are three countries that continue to hunt whales at the moment, and those are Japan, which has actually two hunts. One is a Southern Ocean hunt and one is a North Pacific hunt. Iceland and Norway. And, yeah, there's sort of different situations in these different countries. I think probably there's a lot of pressure also coming on in Iceland. They really, again, don't have a local market for whale meat, and they've been trying to revive an export to Japan, and that's really fallen flat on its face, because, well, some shipments have been rejected because of contamination of the whale meat, and there's simply not the market there. They're trying to export.
Is that the mercury contamination, or what kind of contamination is that?
I'm not sure exactly which contamination it is, but they the meat gets tested in Japan, and we've also had issues with the dolphin meat in Japan being tested and showing contamination as well. So Iceland has really been trying to revive this export to Japan, and that's just not possible when there isn't even even a market for the whale meat that Japan's own program is coming back with. They, you know, more than 5,000 tonnes in cold storage is not a thriving market.
No. Okay, so that's a great victory then for whaling. So that's really something to be celebrated, isn't it?
I think everyone who's been involved in, you know, the campaign to end whaling will be having a good celebration on this and you know, counting it as a good step in progress. But I think, you know, no one's confident that this is really the end, and we do need to keep that pressure up in every avenue.
Mm. Okay, so moving on to something else which is close to your heart, the tuna and fishing. So where's the campaign at with that?
Well, globally, tuna stocks have really been... they've declined a lot in the last 50 years. And just this week, the most endangered tuna stock, which we actually fish here in New Zealand, southern bluefin tuna, our government announced that they would be increasing the quota for this critically endangered species. So we're very very much at the forefront of this campaign. We've got the possible end to tuna on our hands.
What I don't understand is why, you know, when tuna around the world is being fished out, why I can still buy a tin of tuna at a very reasonable cost when I'm thinking, isn't this heavily endangered? Shouldn't this be really expensive? And also, why would the government make that decision?
Well, there's a number of different tuna species, and they range from the southern bluefin tuna, which is listed as critically endangered. There's two other bluefin and an albacore tuna, which are critically endangered. But they also range down to things like skipjack tuna, which is still relatively abundant. So, you know, what you're most likely to find in a can is going to be a skipjack tuna. But what we're also seeing is that even those skipjacks and other tunas that were once thought to be limitless are starting to go into decline. The Japanese, at the last Tuna Commission meeting in the Pacific, their scientists reported that their local catches of skipjack were declining, and they were getting quite alarmed about this. So we're seeing... basically a serial depletion, and fishing vessels that once fished in the Mediterranean have simply moved to the Indian Ocean next, further afield in the Atlantic, and are now fishing in the Pacific. So here we've actually got, you know, one of the last relatively healthy tuna fishing grounds left, but it's now being targeted by an increasing and a growing fleet of vessels from around the world who've fished out their tuna stocks closer to home.
Hmm. Okay, so what can people do? Because when I look at, is it Forest and Bird? Someone's put out like a list of fish that you should be eating, and basically there's actually nothing on it. I mean, you know, I think it's sardines. I think that's the only thing I could actually eat on this list of fish. Because even snapper was supposed to be endangered.
There's two lists available. Forest and Bird has got a good fish guide, and they basically take a traffic light approach to it. So they've marked fish from green into red based on how healthy the fish stock is, how destructive the fishing method is. And I think that they don't have any fish that are left in green. So you really have to kind of make an evaluation of those ones that are in the yellow category.
Mm.
Greenpeace also has a red list. So we've focused on those species that are really at the worst end of the scale that you should avoid buying. So they're kind of complementary lists in a way.
And so on your list is what?
Well, tuna is certainly on the list, but it's kind of complicated with each fish species. There's often different ways to catch it, and sometimes there's different species within what we know as tuna, and what we buy at the supermarket may only say tuna in it. So that's one of the problems, is that what we buy is not properly labelled, and not labelled to the standard that it is, you know, in the UK or in most of Europe these days, where it will give the exact species as well as in some cases how and where it was caught. And that's really important information to differentiate, you know, between one type of tuna and another, and whether what you're eating is having a bad impact on the oceans.
So if I want to eat fish, how do I go about eating fish? Or do I just have to say, well, I'm actually not going to eat fish? I mean, what's the strategy? Can I catch my own snapper or get a friend to catch it? Does that work?
Yeah, I guess the best fish that you can eat is the one that you know the heritage of. So if you've caught it yourself, you know that you've caught it using a method that doesn't have bycatch. So, you know, unless you happen to own a high seas bottom trawler, then one that you've caught yourself is going to be more sustainable. And also the Ministry of Fisheries puts out statistics on which fish stocks are overfished and which aren't. So, for example, snapper on the west coast of the North Island is actually quite overfished. It's close to 10% of its natural level. animals. So in some areas, species are in more trouble than in others.
Right, okay. And is there a way that I can buy sustainably fished tuna? I mean, I know this... Yeah.
At the moment, New Zealand's seafood market is really lagging behind what's the standard internationally. So we've seen huge shifts, particularly in Europe and North America, and I guess the UK has really led the way. And that's been a real shift towards better information to customers so that they can make the right choices, and also retailers that will only stock sustainable fish, so you can actually have confidence in the retailer as a whole that they're not going to be selling you something that's, you know, bottom trawled or has a sea lion bycatch or whatever. So I guess that one of the things to do in the interim here while that information isn't available is just to ask for it. So to ask when you're at the supermarket what species it is, where it was caught, how it was caught, and arm yourself with a little information and simply don't buy fish from someone that can't answer those questions in a satisfactory way or gives an answer that indicates that it's coming from an unsustainable fishery.
Mm. Although I just see myself doing that at the fish counter at the supermarket and people just looking at me like I'm a bit of a nutter. You know, because I don't think the people who work there necessarily know where the fish... I mean, they can tell me whether it's come in today or yesterday, but I mean, aside from that...
Well, I've certainly asked that in fish counters myself, and I think that it only takes a few people to ask those questions before those people will be going back to their managers and passing that on and asking for the information themselves so that they're prepared to deal with future questions. Mm-hmm. So it starts that turnaround quite quickly. And I guess one of the things that's been quite big in the UK shift towards sustainable fish has been the movie The End of the Line, which came out a couple of years ago in the UK and last year here. And really, it was the first movie about the overfishing that's facing the whole world. And that was a real kind of turning point for people's understanding that we're taking more fish out of the oceans than they can sustain, and we need to change that or else we are going to end up in a world without fish.
Mm. So how are these decisions made? Like, I don't really understand why John Key or the government would approve more fishing of a species which is either endangered or becoming endangered.
Well,
what's that about? What's at stake?
I guess in the case of southern bluefin tuna, the problem is that there's an incredibly strong industry lobby on the Ministry of Fisheries, and so they've made a decision which simply isn't in keeping with New Zealand's reputation on conservation management or the reputation that we try and build on sustainable fisheries management. I mean, it's completely incongruous that we would be not just continuing to catch but increasing the catch of a critically endangered species when the scientific committee of the fisheries management have told us that there's only 4.6% left. I mean, that is really getting down to desperately low levels.
So is there something that the public can do there?
The decision maker in this has been the Minister of Fisheries, and I guess that taking it one step up and writing a letter either to the Minister of Fisheries or to the Prime Minister about this would be a great piece of action to take. Most of the bluefin tuna that's caught here in New Zealand waters doesn't end up here. I mean, it's a very, very, it's a delicacy and a very expensive product, and almost all of it gets exported to Japan. So it's not something that we can, you know, boycott here because it's not being sold here. But to make that voice known and, you know, write a letter to the editor or to the Prime Minister or Minister of Fisheries would, you know, just raise the fact that this isn't going on. You know, they're not getting away below the radar doing this. We actually know what's happening, and we don't approve of what they're doing in our name.
Mm-hmm. Now, New Zealand is the country that's got the fourth biggest amount of sea around it or something like that. I read some sort of bizarre statistic like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we have a very big, it's called the Exclusive Economic Zone, and that's the area that we have more or less jurisdiction over in terms of fisheries and other activities in the ocean. So yeah, we have a huge ocean resource, and it's one that we really need to look after, and so far we've done a lot of overfishing, and there's some stocks in real trouble in those waters. And you know,
so who fishes in those waters? Do we give licenses to other countries to fish in those waters, or is that where New Zealand companies are fishing, or how does that work?
Well, New Zealand companies hold the quota for fishing New Zealand fish, but in many cases they'll take on foreign charter vessels to fish some of that catch. And, you know, just to take the southern bluefin fishery as an example, that's around half of it is caught by New Zealand vessels and around half is caught by Japanese charter vessels. All of these vessels are fishing with long lines. They're setting, you know, more than hundreds of kilometres of long line to catch these fish, and long lining has got a very high rate of bycatch. So the southern bluefin tuna fishery, they actually catch several times more sharks than they do southern bluefin tunas. And in New Zealand waters, they're still legally allowed to fin those sharks and dump them overboard, dump their bodies overboard. So there's a lot of things going on in our vast waters that most New Zealanders simply don't know about, and I think most wouldn't approve of if they did know.
Mm. So what are the initiatives that you would like to see in relation to New Zealand waters, and what are some of the things that could be happening that aren't happening?
Well, I guess one of the problems in our waters is that we've got a very, very high reliance on bottom trawling, which is one of the most destructive methods of fishing. It's essentially dragging huge weighted nets over the seabed and is very destructive to catch deep sea fish, which themselves are very, very vulnerable to overfishing. So, you know, orange roughy, three stocks were fished to collapse. One has started to recover now, but they're really in a poor state, and this is a fish that lives to over 100 years, and you know the risk of overfishing that species is just too great. So we actually need to shift away from bottom trawling and onto other methods. When it comes to tuna fisheries, most of our tuna fisheries, we share them with a wider region. So southern bluefin tuna breeds northwest of Australia, and we share that fishery with Australia and with several Asian countries that also fish for it. And then there's big eye, yellowfin, albacore and skipjack tunas, which are the tunas that we're more likely to buy here in New Zealand. And these stocks breed up in the tropical Pacific, and we share them with essentially with our Pacific Island neighbours, and increasingly with the countries that are coming to the Pacific as the last relatively healthy tuna stock. So in all of these situations, we actually have to cooperate to set in place rules, and it's a lot more complicated than one country setting its own rules, which already has enough challenges itself. Mm. And, you know, we've got to go to these forums with a strong advocacy for conservation, and we've seen that lacking. And, for example, to go to the Commission for the Conservation of Southern Bluefin Tunas, having just doubled our catch in the last 5 years, that's a very kind of weak position to be trying to tell everyone else to get into line and to reduce fishing effort when we're doing the opposite ourselves.
No, absolutely. Now, you've got a job that I'm sure lots of people would be absolutely fascinated to do or to be involved in or whatever. So how does one get to be campaigns person on oceans for Greenpeace? What kind of background have you got for that?
Well, I studied in Dunedin, and I studied botany and ecology and specialised in marine. So I've got that background, but I guess a big part of it is just that interest in advocacy and interest in kind of changing the world, I guess, in whatever way that you can. And I used to work for Forest and Bird. I've worked for the New Zealand Underwater Association. So it's been sort of a transition through different roles, I guess.
Okay. And people can volunteer at Greenpeace? You always take on volunteers?
Yeah, people can sign up to volunteer on our website. There's a volunteer form that you can fill in, and our volunteer coordinator, who I sit next to in the office, will get back to them and, you know, work out what skills they've got, what their interests are and how they'd like to help.
Lovely. And have you got an internship program as well for people who are a bit more serious?
We advertise internships on our jobs vacancy list, so they'll be advertised in the same way that we advertise vacancies.
Lovely. And of course you can always join Greenpeace if you're interested in saving the planet.
Absolutely. And if anyone's prepared to move to Australia, I know that there's an oceans campaign vacancy over there at the moment.
Oh, great. Tara, maybe you could be oceans campaigner, no? Bit young in the future. Anyway, thanks so much. Carly's got to run for a ferry. Thanks so much for coming in to talk to us, and good luck with all the campaigns.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, and the interviews are replayed on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. They're also available as a download from our website, www.waihekeradio.org.nz. Island Life is brought to you by Island, the shop with Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Island, Ocean View Road, Onirola.